For a lot of people in Wisconsin, this warmer weather means camping trips, weekend hiking, long bike trips, running, getting out on the lakes, and of course, kayaking. With all of this outdoor recreation can come some damage to the natural places and spaces we love. What do you do to make sure you're being environmentally conscious while having your outdoor fun? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have some advice, tips, maybe even brands or products to recommend that you love because of their care for the environment? And what do you do to leave an outdoor space in the condition you found it in? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or leave a comment on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Liz Wessel is the chair of membership and fundraising committees for Wisconsin Sierra Club John Muir chapter. Liz, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, good afternoon, Rob.
Well, first let's talk about the mindset of getting outdoors and being, I guess, kind of eco-conscious, keeping the green thinking in mind. How should we be thinking as we go out for our camping or hiking or whatever?
Yeah, I'm a big hiker, so, and my husband and I are big picnickers, so we go out quite a bit in the summer. And, you know, part of the reason we all go outside is because we enjoy being in those landscapes or in those places. So I think it starts with you're out there to enjoy the natural world where you're going. And so you want to think about that and respect that when you get there.
How can our outdoor recreation be hard on the local environment?
It's pretty easy to see sometimes. So one of the things I had been thinking about, what bugs me the most when I'm out there, what I see, and one thing for sure is staying on the trails. A lot of people say travel and camp on durable surfaces. You'll hear that. Basically what they're saying is stay on the trail. Trails have been designed specifically to go through the landscape with the least amount of impact, and it really bothers me when I see people who have cut, you know, between the trail and they create a whole thing. You could be damaging, you know, species, plants, animals, but it also creates erosion, and that's just not good for the whole landscape or for the next people who come along. So we all want to see a nice landscape and a good, clean trail. So that would be a start for me.
And a lot of outdoor recreation involves bringing some form of stuff, including food and other items. What kind of things can we think about as we're shopping and gearing up for a trip?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, the motto there is pack it in, pack it out. And I like to think we bring a lot of fresh food now. People are really into eating better. And if you want to bring that fruit, and my husband and I have this conversation all the time, but don't throw the banana peel or the orange peels out because they just don't decompose. And for the next person who comes along, it's really garbage. You know, it doesn't belong in the Wisconsin landscape. You know, those are tropical fruits. They don't belong here. So you really want to think about what belongs in the landscape and what doesn't. And that could be whether you're paddling or whether you're hiking or wherever you are. Pack it in, pack it out. I was also thinking about snacks, and just recently I was making, for our fundraiser, I tried out a granola bar recipe, and I did a test batch, and what I did was I cut up those bars, put them into baggies, small size baggies, put them in the freezer, and now I've got baggies of granola bars that I can pull out at a moment's notice if we, for some reason, it's a beautiful evening and we want to go for a hike on the Ice Age Trail. I can just grab those and ready to go, and there's no wrappers.
Talk us through that recipe a little bit. I know it's Food Friday tomorrow here on Central Time. You can give us a little taste of this granola bar recipe.
It's an awesome recipe I found. Some people may remember Molly Katzen, who wrote the Moosewood Cookbook. And she made it's in one of her other books, and it's a breakfast cookie bar. And it's amazing. It had apple juice and some other things, not a lot of sugar in it. But it was oats and wheat germ and just a lot of cinnamon, which I like. So it was a really, really nice recipe. And it's not super crunchy or dry, but just right for eating along the way. And my husband and I have been eating up the batch, as you say. But it's, you know, just keep looking around for things like that. But anyway, that one was a good one. It's called the Breakfast Cookie Bar, and it's in, I can't remember which one of her cookbooks.
Well, yeah, when I was reading tips online, a lot of people are like, yeah, for the sporting outdoors people, there are a lot of single serving packaged goo things and bar things out there. And yeah, even if you do pack in and pack out, maybe that's more waste than you need when you go out to the wilderness.
Yeah, and here's another thought for food. I have a dehydrator, and I make my own fruit roll-ups. But you can make all sorts of roll-ups. And a lot of people are getting into drying and preserving food now, so that's probably a lot more available to people. But you can make those roll-ups. They keep in the refrigerator for a long time and then bring them with you when you go on it. And a little bite of raspberry fruit roll-up does wonders when you're slowing down on the trail.
Talking to Liz Wessel from Wisconsin Sierra Club, John Muir chapter, talking about protecting the environment while we're out enjoying it, whether we're hiking, doing an outdoor sport, paddling, you name it. And still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234 if you want to give advice or get advice. Do you have tips on keeping the environment protected while you're out in it, camping or whatever you like to do outside? What kind of things do you do? Who taught you kind of that that mentality of green, friendly outdoor recreation? Or if you have questions, need some advice from Liz, you can also call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Liz Wessel stays with us from the Sierra Club John Muir chapter. We're talking about enjoying Wisconsin's outdoors, camping, recreating, paddling, running, you name it, and protecting the local environment while we're at it. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you do to make sure you pack in, or pack out, I should say, what you pack in? Have you made your own forms of outdoor snack food that maybe use a little less packaging? Are you careful to try not to spread invasive species while you're out and about? Have you observed behavior that isn't so friendly to the environment? Or do you need some advice from Liz? You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Liz, I mentioned invasive species there, and there's definitely a lot of tips involving things like firewood or little shoe scrapers at a lot of places. What kind of things can we do when we're out there to not spread stuff that's not supposed to be there?
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up, because I was actually just thinking about that with firewood. I mean, there's a couple things, fires and firewood, but on firewood, because Wisconsin is in a quarantine the entire state for emerald ash borer, you really should not be carrying wood from one place to another. Buy your wood locally wherever you end up for your campfire. And then on campfires and fires, you know, one of the other things that bothers me when I'm out there is brand new fire rings when there's already a really good one that exists. So don't create new ones. Use what's there. And there are some great tips for how to build a fire and leave no trace. And then when you're in, you know, a campsite, take care of the fire pit that's there. I remember my husband and I arrived one time, and we did a little cleaning action. People were trying to burn things that really don't burn. So separate out what you're doing. Don't burn your plastic garbage. Your aluminum doesn't burn. You know, think about what's going in your fire and enjoy it. You don't want things that are in there that are going to create hazardous gases or things like that. So careful on the firewood. And then the other thing on invasive species is remember where there are signs in particular, they talk about brushing off your feet, your boots, at certain trailheads and stuff, just so you're not spreading the seeds or invasive species around. And that's true for boating. Most people who boat know that when you come into the landing, you need to be careful not to spread zebra mussels and other people hitchhiking on your boat that want to go to the next lake. So there definitely are things that we can do, and most of them are pretty well marked at those locations.
Now, I've seen advice, getting back to those fires, you know, it seems natural to gather up local brush and wood branches lying around in the ground. I've seen people suggesting maybe don't do that because some species rely on that sort of fallen wood as a habitat.
Yeah, there's probably a couple of ways of thinking about it. I think it's better, though, if you are out in the backwoods, you're not going to obviously carry firewood with you. So you're definitely going to be wanting to pick up stuff that's already dead on the ground. I have seen people go in with hatchets, and I always wonder about that because burning green wood isn't particularly great. But, you know, in a campground, I'd rather buy the local wood from the campfire people rather than pick up, because it's true. Part of the natural process of a forest or any place you go is the decay and the turnover and the life cycle of all those natural objects in that landscape. So, again, you're respecting the landscape as it is. And if you have that choice and it's accessible, why not? Why not use that campfire wood?
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Barante is with us in Bayfield. Barante, hi.
Hi. Hey, Rob and Liz. So I'm an outdoor educational professional, and Liz, you've been talking a lot about leave no trace ethics, like travel and camp on durable surfaces. And I kind of have a problem with leave no trace because it takes humans kind of out of the natural equation. It says you don't belong here. And also it creates this systemic problem of not in my backyard-ism, which, you know, people are like, oh, so I can't have a campfire or I need ultralight gear, and so they buy really unsustainable products and bring them out and say, okay, well, I'm good now because I'm not kind of breaking twigs. I'm wondering what you think of that.
Bronte, thanks for the call. So the maybe the gear we pack in doesn't have an effect on the place we're, say, camping, but he's saying, well, what about what it took to make that stuff, Liz?
Well, I think, and he's also pointing out that the leave no trace, you know, I think it really depends on your circumstances and where you are. If we're talking about day trips and things like that, I think most of the areas we're going to are pretty well used, our state parks, our trails and stuff, and I think there's a lot of use that's already there. So it's not like it's a pristine environment. Where some of the higher principles of leave no trace, where you really can, and I've been in some of those areas where it's dispersed camping and there really are no established campsites, and the idea is to leave the lightest footprint that you can. I'm not an extremist about it. And I certainly enjoy foraging, which is another reason why you bring the extra bag in your day pack, one for garbage and one for foraging. And in those circumstances, you are going to be, you know, breaking some twigs. You're going to be getting into the berry bush. But you know what? That's okay. Most of our public lands allow for foraging. And I think it's a really good way for people to bond with what's out on the land, to find, you know, the mushrooms and the berries and things like that. So I don't think I'm going down that road of, like, don't touch the land at all. And, Rob, your point was slightly different. Can you repeat that?
Well, he had mentioned if you're bringing that lighter weight gear, the alternate cooking materials,
right,
he was worried that the production of those has wider ecological implications.
Well, I also think, yeah, people who want to go that far should really think through the life cycle analysis and make their own judgments. I'm not going to be the one to tell them on that. But I also think, you know, a lot of people can't afford a lot of stuff. And so the idea here is to be sensible and to think about what experience you're having, and then how do you respect the experience of the next person behind you. It's pretty common sense stuff. And so I wouldn't necessarily say that you need to go out and buy all the gear. I must admit, though, I was going to say something about insects, and one of the places where it starts is with clothing. The one piece of clothing that I did buy that I really, really use a lot is I bought a lightweight pair of long hiking pants, and I absolutely love them. I wear them all the time, and, you know, they have ties at the bottom, so I'm somewhat sensitive to mosquitoes, so I really don't want them biting me. And I will go so far as to wear long pants in the summer sometimes. So that's my piece of gear that I think is essential.
We've also talked about ticks and mosquitoes on the show today, Liz. So yeah, those hiking pants sound pretty good, actually. So what are some other, go ahead.
Yeah, and I was going to say along those lines, if and a lot of us do, if you get to the point where you need pesticides or insecticides to protect yourself, and there's some health reasons now, I would say, one, don't buy aerosols. Aerosols spread the insecticide way beyond where you want it. So a pump spray, you put it on your hand, and you put it where you want it. We've all been in those places or at a party or something, and somebody's just spraying sunscreen or a pesticide, and you're just choking on it. That's exactly the point. It gets put into the air. We all breathe it in, and it goes places where it's not supposed to be. And some of those can be very hazardous for some of the natural environment. So the plant, some of the insects, but the fish in particular, some of the insecticides are bad for them.
In our last couple of minutes, Liz, any tips you want to share that we haven't gotten into yet?
Well, I'm just looking through here. I wanted to talk a little bit about picnicking. I said at the beginning, my husband and I do a lot of that. We actually kind of live with a picnic basket in the summer, almost ready to go. And there's a lot of ways you can save on disposables. Our picnic basket generally has, some cloth napkins in it, a dish towel, a small cutting board, a garbage bag, and some silverware. And we usually bring an extra sturdy garbage bag, from a grocery store where we just throw our dirty dishes in when we're done. But that's just kind of standard for us. It's in the kitchen area in the summer, and, at a last minute, if it's a beautiful evening, we'll just grab that and go to a park or go, out on the Ice Age Trail or some other place that we really like. So, really good idea to think about. You can do picnics and other things with a lot of reusables, and we have a lot of tablecloths and things like that that we have around. So
we'll leave it there for now. Liz, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, and thanks for covering this topic.
That's Liz Wessel, Chair of Membership and Fundraising Committees for Wisconsin Sierra Club John Muir Chapter. She joined us to talk about being environmentally conscious in the outdoors this summer. I love that, having the cutting board and silverware handy, because being in Wisconsin, we're going to Devil's Lake or whatever. We got a block of cheese. And then what do you break it off? You all take turns gnawing at the cheese. I love just keeping that cutting board always at the ready. President Trump's pick to head the Central Intelligence Agency, Gina Haspel, was grilled by the Senate Intelligence Committee yesterday as part of the confirmation process. Haspel currently serves as the deputy director of the CIA. If she's confirmed, the career agent would be the first female director in the agency's history. But Haspel has been a controversial choice to lead the CIA for some. Following September 11th, she oversaw a secret facility in Thailand that used so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, including waterboarding and sleep deprivation. Our next guest is here to talk about Gina Haspel's roles within the CIA and the politics surrounding her potential appointment. Ian Hurd is an associate professor of political science and director of the International Studies Program at Northwestern University. He's the author of How to Do Things with International Law. Ian, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
That seems like a lot of yesterday's confirmation hearings, a lot of the talk here goes back to that, the waterboarding, the so-called enhanced interrogation techniques used by the CIA after 9/11. This is a legacy that we're going to be arguing about for a long time, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. And it raises the issue of how the United States reckons with this past, where torture was used against prisoners after 9/11, and there hasn't really been a full accounting for what happened and who did it and how to hold people accountable in this country.
Now let's talk about Gina Haspel. As a CIA agent, we don't, by the nature of the job, know every detail about her career, but what do we know coming into these confirmations?
Well, we know that she was in charge of this secret CIA prison in Thailand, and where, torture and deaths happened of prisoners. And we also know that she was the one who drafted an order to the CIA to destroy videotapes of torture sessions. And so she has come to personify this American torture program in the early 2000s, and that's why her controversial her nomination is so controversial.
And the people arguing for her say we got valuable intelligence from the use of things like waterboarding. The tapes showed the faces of CIA agents. Could if they were leaked, it could have put them at risk. That's what her supporters in the Senate and beyond have been saying. Is there something to those arguments?
Well, let's be clear. So the CIA has said that they didn't think any useful intelligence came from the torture sessions. So there's not really any evidence that it produced useful information, but it throws into a really big open question whether we expect the rule of law to obtain when it comes to how the U.S. treats its political prisoners.
And let's talk about international law and what the international community looks at when the United States, when these programs came out from the United States. What does that do for the United States in terms of the international community?
Well, under international law, torture is very clearly illegal. It's illegal by treaty, and it's also illegal as a peremptory norm of international law, which is to say it's a rule that everybody agrees should exist and that nobody is allowed to exempt themselves from. So there's a very clear, well-established law against torturing people that goes all the way back to Nuremberg. And there's really not any controversy about that. There's really nobody who suggests that it's a bad idea to outlaw torture. So that's extremely well established. International law doesn't have any mechanisms for enforcing the laws against people who might want to violate them. And I think that's why this becomes such a tricky issue in American domestic politics. It comes down to the question of, well, if what you want to do is against the law, what do you do? And one answer would be, well, maybe you don't do it. Another answer might be you change the law. But the third answer that the Bush administration took is you do it anyway, but you try to keep it secret or you try to make a case for why it's not breaking the law. So the law against torture is very clear in human rights law. There's really no controversy there. Here's a case where the government in the U.S. really wanted to torture people and to break the law, and now we're having to figure out how to deal with that aftermath. What do we do? How do we hold people accountable? There's the controversy.
Talking to Ian Hurd from Northwestern University about CIA director nominee Gina Haspel. She had Senate Intelligence Committee hearings yesterday. I want to play one of the exchanges from that, one of the more tense ones. Senator Kamala Harris, Democrat from California, had this exchange with Haspel yesterday about Haspel's opinion now about the use of torture by CIA agents. Here's a listen.
Do you believe that the previous interrogation techniques were immoral?
Senator, I believe that CIA officers to whom you referred...
It's a yes or no answer. Do you believe the previous interrogation techniques were immoral? I'm not asking do you believe they were legal. I'm asking do you believe they were immoral?
Senator, I believe that CIA did extraordinary work to prevent another attack on this country, given the legal tools that we were authorized to use.
Please answer yes or no. Do you believe in hindsight that those techniques were immoral?
Senator, what I believe sitting here today is that I support the higher moral standard we have decided to hold ourselves to.
Can you please answer the question?
Senator, I think I've answered the question.
No, you've not. Do you believe the previous techniques, now armed with hindsight, do you believe they were immoral? Yes or no?
Senator, I believe that we should hold ourselves to the moral standard outlined in the Army Field Manual.
Okay, so I understand that you've not answered the question, but I'm going to move on.
What do you make of that exchange, Ian?
Well, it's really quite striking that Haspel is not willing to answer whether she thinks it's moral or not, since she approved it back when she was in the office and presumably thought it was the right thing to do. But in her confirmation, she's unwilling to stand up and either defend what she was doing or make what seems like a more sensible admission, which is that the kinds of behaviors we're talking about are clearly immoral. But there's an interesting gap here between legality and morality, or at least one can recognize that they operate on different criteria. We can look at the law and see that this is a clearly illegal set of practices. But we might use a different kind of judgment to think about whether it's moral or not when we hear the descriptions of what we're really talking about. So chaining people to the wall naked for 56 hours at a time and leaving the lights on all night, this sort of thing. I think that it strains credulity to imagine that could be moral. But the play between what's legal and what's moral lead to two different kinds of conversations. But Haspel is really strikingly evasive in that answer.
One absence at these hearings, Senator John McCain, who of course survived torture himself, captured during the Vietnam War. He did tweet last night, however, quoting here, "I believe Gina Haspel is a patriot who loves our country and has devoted her professional life to its service and defense. However, her role in overseeing the use of torture is disturbing, and her refusal to acknowledge torture's immorality is disqualifying." End of the quote there. What impact does Senator McCain have when he says something like that? And what impact does his absence as a strong voice on issues of torture have on this committee hearing?
Yeah, he carries a lot of weight on the subject, both because of his personal experience and because of his long role in the Senate. I think he raises a very clear question about what the United States is, in a sense. So he seems to be saying that he doesn't want to live in a country where the government tortures its political opponents, and that he sees that as a very fundamental commitment. He's not willing to promote somebody into a job like this who doesn't agree with that basic premise. I think that's a pretty straightforward and simple position that sets aside any question about law or accountability or crimes and gets down to the basic issue of what does it mean to live in this country. And for McCain, it seems torturing political prisoners is not something that is reconcilable with the United States as he understands it.
We're talking to Ian Hurd now, Associate Professor of Political Science and Director of the International Studies Program at Northwestern University. With us to talk about Gina Haspel, President Trump's pick to head the CIA. She's been a controversial pick given her role in the CIA's what they called enhanced interrogation programs following September 11th. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should Gina Haspel be confirmed? Do you think we've resolved this debate over waterboarding? Do you think it could come back? Do you think it should come back as a tactic? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
If I am confirmed as director, you have my solemn commitment that I will position this agency to provide the intelligence support our country needs to meet the challenges of today and those of tomorrow.
We're hearing the opening statement there from current CIA Deputy Director Gina Haspel in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee yesterday. She is President Trump's pick to take over that agency. She's facing criticism over her role in the CIA in the past and the Bureau's use of torture. Our guest is Ian Hurd, Associate Professor of Political Science and Director of the International Studies Program at Northwestern University. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Should Gina Haspel be confirmed as the new director of the CIA? What do you make of her history? What did you think of that confirmation hearing yesterday and the use of waterboarding in the past? And maybe in the future, President Trump has spoken favorably of it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. To your calls now, Jim is with us in Saukville. Jim, hi.
Hey, good afternoon.
What do you think?
I think she should not be confirmed. The way she answered her questions yesterday, it makes it very clear that she does not view what she did as immoral or wrong.
Jim, thanks a lot for that call. And Ian, she seemed to say she would, she said what Jim said there, but also that she would not do things in the future like waterboarding, if I heard her correctly, if she were confirmed. Is that good enough?
Well, I'm not sure she ever really said that. And she certainly never accounted for why she would be comfortable with torture in practice in the past, but suddenly now in the confirmation decide that she's not comfortable with it. So it left more questions unanswered. And it felt a little bit like she had one story when she was reading the script that someone had prepared for her and a very different way of talking when she was off on her own. So it left me a little worried.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We heard from Paul in Rice Lake. He says, why refer to the prisoners at these detention centers as political prisoners, as you did earlier, Ian, rather than as terrorists or suspected terrorists?
Well, they were in prison because the American government decided that it had some thought that they were against the United States. And that seems to me to be pretty much the very definition of a political prisoner. Remember, these people were never criminal defendants. They were never tried for things. Most of them had never even had charges presented to them. So these are people who were essentially plucked off the streets around the world and made to disappear into secret American prisons. That sounds to me very much like what you would describe as a political prisoner if we were talking about, let's say, a South American dictatorship or the gulags or any other secret prison system.
The argument from some anyway at the time was these aren't exactly criminal suspects. They're not exactly members of an enemy army, but they're people who we know, we, the American government at the time, have taken action to harm American citizens. They're maybe we don't have the right definition for them, but they're something other than simply political prisoners.
Well, that's not quite right either, since many of these people were picked up when the Americans didn't really know who they were, but they just thought that because they had some association with somebody the Americans were looking for, they might be people that should be taken this way. And certainly none of that evidence against any of these people has ever been made public. So I think back to John McCain, it's a question of how much power are you willing to give to the United States secret sort of agencies like the CIA, and give it to them on faith. That is, allow them the power to abduct people around the world and torture them, disappear them, without them ever having to explain it. For McCain, it seems quite clear that he's not willing to give the U.S. government that much power without asking for an accounting and things done in public in a democratic way. It seems like McCain is onto something there.
What are you watching for in the future of the CIA? It seems like over the years, over the decades, something comes out about what the CIA has done around the world in different situations. There's pushback, new limits put on. Something new happens 5 or 10 years later. What are you watching for now?
Well, I think the real key may be in Congress. So, the secret intelligence agencies like the CIA will always want to do their things in secret and not be held accountable. The American legal and political system sets up Congress as the oversight over those secret operations. And it's been a while now since we've seen Congress do that role with any effectiveness. What I would like to see is more activism in Congress to hold accountable these secret agencies, accepting that there may be some reasons why secrecy is necessary, but Congress should be doing the accounting. And that's one reason why I think these Senate hearings are so useful on Haspel. They raise the question in public of how the American people feel about the torture that was done in their name to people who, as we've said, were never charged with crimes and probably never will be charged with crimes, so they're not criminal suspects. So I think that public accountability needs to come from Congress. It's a little tough these days to imagine that happening, but that's my hope.
We'll leave it there for now. Ian, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Ian Hurd, Associate Professor of Political Science and Director of the International Studies Program at Northwestern University. He's the author of How to Do Things with International Law. He was with us today to talk about President Trump's pick to lead the Central Intelligence Agency, that's Gina Haspel, her history with the agency, including controversies surrounding the use of torture on terrorism suspects following September 11th during her tenure at a site in Thailand.